Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's been a bad week for the White House. It started with the controversy over Vice President Cheney's handling of his accidental shooting of a friend on a hunting trip in Texas. Cheney was criticized for waiting 4 days before speaking about the accident, which he eventually did Wednesday in a Fox News interview.
The image of him falling is something I'll never be able to get out of my mind. I fired, and there's Harry falling, and it was, I'd have to say, one of the worst days of my life.
Also, more criticism was leveled against the administration's response to Hurricane Katrina this week. First, House Republicans published a damaging report faulting the administration for failing to act quickly. Then, senators hammered Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff during public hearings on the issue. Here's one exchange between Chertoff and Michigan Senator Carl Levin.
How did these screw-ups happen? I mean, have you looked into them?
Yes, the answer is I have looked into
and
them.
And how did they happen?
I think it's a combination. Some of these messages never got to the operations center. Some of them did, but there were conflicting stories.
And the controversy over the White House warrantless domestic spying program continues as a House committee has decided to push forward with its investigation. Well, joining us to talk about the week in Washington are Richard Wolff. He's political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Also, Alexis Simmendinger. She's White House correspondent for the National Journal. Welcome, Alexis.
Hi, Deborah.
Let's start with Vice President Cheney and the much-talked-about hunting accident. The vice president's in his home state of Wyoming today to address the legislature there. He's been out of the public eye for much of the week, with the exception of Wednesday. Do you think that Cheney's actions here and the subsequent stories about power and secrecy will affect the White House and the Republicans, Richard?
Yeah, of course it does, and not just because of the sort of firestorm around this week, but it affected in two ways. First of all, Dick Cheney has benefited over the course of the last 5 years by portraying himself as the sort of protector-in-chief. He may be dark and brooding and reclusive, but he's got security on his mind. Unfortunately for him, the story has broken through beyond people like us, beyond the Beltway, to the mainstream, to the late-night jokes, and he's become something of a figure of fun. The second reason it's a problem for him is that this was obviously a bad PR case. It involved an accident with a lobbyist, of all people, and in terms of his role rallying the base in an election year, people are going to think twice about taking him on the campaign trail. That's a problem for Republicans generally.
There was also the criticism of Hurricane Katrina this week, and Republicans and Democrats seem to agree that the government seriously botched this response. How significant is it that Republicans in the House and Senate have been so critical of this, Alexis?
Well, I don't think it's at all surprising because the entire country, in fact, the entire world, looked at what happened during Katrina and thought that it was just horrendous, abysmal. And Republicans were as much a part of that outcry as were Democrats, and particularly Republicans who are representing constituents in the various states that were affected. And I'm including the states that were receiving evacuees as much as those states that were affected by the storm. So it has been in some ways a nonpartisan issue. What's interesting is that, and worrying for the White House certainly in the coverage that I've been doing, is the question about where it will lead and what it is that the administration can do to rescue itself from what is universal condemnation over what happened. And of course, the hurricane season in the United States begins again in June, and you could tell that Secretary Chertoff was being pressured by those on the Hill to figure out what it is that they're going to do to reconcile all of the failures within a very short amount of time. He did not sound like someone who knew that he had accomplished that.
There's also domestic spying, as we mentioned. The House Intelligence Committee has agreed to open a congressional inquiry. The Senate's put off any inquiry for the time being. Richard, what do you think this signifies?
Well, the politics of this is shifting, and there's a lot of behind-the-scenes activity to try and neutralize what's going on. You know, what it signifies is that the White House thought at the start of the year and the end of last year that it could effectively campaign against Democrats and its critics in general by portraying them as being weak on these questions of defending the homeland, and specifically the eavesdropping program. The politics, in fact, is much more complicated. There is bipartisan concern here, It stretches not just across different wings of the Republican Party, especially the Libertarian side, but also this is a problem between two branches of government, and there are members of Congress who want to reassert themselves at this point and feel that they have an advantage in doing so, again, in an election year. So the politics are shifting. It's not controllable. You know, there is a certain pushback from Republican leaders and from the White House, but this is still very much in flux and isn't taking the kind of clean path that the White House would like. Hmm.
Alexis, what would you say about that, particularly in light of the efforts to perhaps change the law because of this, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and also the ruling from a federal judge that the administration needs to hand over internal documents about this spying program? Would you also agree that the politics here are shifting and this is getting more complicated?
Well, it's incredibly complex, and I would agree with everything that Richard said. You know, from the White House vantage point, they're dealing with four main questions right now on the Hill, let alone what's happening in the courts. What will happen in the courts will take longer to snake out. But right now, up front, they're dealing with four questions that members of both parties are asking. Is what the president did legal? Should there be warrants to allow this to continue to happen? Should the federal law, the FISA law, the surveillance law, be amended in some way to accommodate what the White House and the administration are doing at NSA? And the fourth question is, should Congress be briefed better and more thoroughly and by offer more information to more members? The White House this week seemed to be pushing back on the first three of those questions and acquiescing only slightly on the question of briefing, being open to legislation to brief members and more often and more completely. But as Richard is pointing out, the complexity of these, both across party lines, the two chambers of Congress, and certainly in the public, the one thing that the White House has going for it and is trying to play up very heavily is that the public, as Richard pointed out, is so far supportive of the idea that if this is helping the administration to combat terror, they're relatively accepting of that. What will have to happen to change public opinion is some concrete example of abuse of this, and the White House is very concerned to make sure that the operational details of what's happening at NSA do not become public.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me then as if both of you would say that these issues have been significant for this White House and for Republicans in general and will reverberate outside of Washington. We've only got about 30 seconds here. Yes?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one thing people in the White House were saying was in some ways they were breathing a sigh of relief that Cheney thing happened because it diverted attention away from these other problems.
Right. Well, thanks very much to both of you for being with us.
Thanks, Deborah.
Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Alexis Simmendinger is White House correspondent for The National Journal. We now turn to NPR political editor Ken Rudin for a look at how the events in Washington are shaping the political prospects of Democrats and Republicans in this year's midterm elections. Ken, we've been talking about some of the problems plaguing the Bush administration. Both reporters say that these problems have far-reaching effects. Would you agree?
Well, certainly, I agree, Deborah. If you look at the polls, if you look at the people, what party they would like to see representing them in Congress, and the Democrats are getting an overwhelming response. Something like 49% would rather have Democrats in control and maybe a low 30s for the Republicans. However, that's when you do a generic Democrat against a generic Republican. And as history has shown, generic Republicans and generic Democrats are not the guys you see on the ballot. You see actual candidates. So things certainly could change by November.
Historically, right, when we've had a second-term president, the out-of-power party tends to gain congressional seats in the midterm elections. It seems like Republicans have given the Democrats plenty of ammunition here, but we're not really hearing a unified message, are we, from the Democrats?
No, and probably on every – I mean, certainly on Katrina you are, but again, Republicans are joining Democrats in the condemnation of what's going on, not only by the Bush administration, but by Governor Blanco and by Mayor Nagin in New Orleans. But on the war, certainly you do have Nancy Pelosi with one view of the war, but you have Democrats running for office in the South who have a completely different perspective on whether there should be an immediate pullout, as Jack Murtha would say, or a systematic pullout. And if you look at the folks who are running for president, the Democrats who are running for president, 2008, John Kerry, John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, Evan Bayh, they all voted for the war, and that's something that the Republicans loved to remind John Kerry and John Edwards about in 2004, and I assume in 2008 as well.
Right. President Bush's political advisor, Karl Rove, recently told Republicans they need to focus on their strengths, which he says are national security issues and the war on terrorism. And he says Republicans have a post-9/11 view of the world. Democrats do not. What do you think of this strategy?
It's worked. We saw it work in 2002 midterm elections. We saw it work against John Kerry in 2004. And why not try it again for 2006? Just yesterday, Karl Rove gave a speech and he said that, look, the eavesdropping thing is we're out to fight the terrorists and we're protecting lives and we're trying to disrupt the Al-Qaeda network. So, again, it always depends on how a pollster asks that question. But I'm not convinced that the American public is upset about the warrantless surveillance, as some people indicate.
But the warrantless surveillance and the war in Iraq and some other things that have happened, don't you think they would have a cumulative effect to sort of spill over into this area as well?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why you see President Bush with very poor polling numbers. Dick Cheney with even lower. I think Dick Cheney is now in the 20s. And you have these Republicans running a disadvantage, plus the fact the headlines about Tom DeLay and Bob Ney and Jack Abramoff. You add that to everything else that's been going on, and you do have a very grim political outlook looking staring the Republicans in the face for November.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned differing views among some of the Democrats, and that may be a reason why that they may not have a unified message. But there are some Democrats, the fighting Democrats, they call themselves, about 55 candidates who are also war veterans. Do you think that the Democrats will be trying to capitalize on the war issue here and how?
Well, it's a very good, I guess I do, and I think it's a very good strategy for the Democrats because, you know, as we said since 2001, the Republicans have been saying that the opposition party are the cut-and-run Democrats who are weak in national security, and that's perhaps why Republicans did so well in 2002, 2004. But when you have these Democrats who fought on the front lines in Iraq and fought on the front lines in Afghanistan, and you have them running like Tammy Duckworth in Illinois, who lost both legs, you know, she's running for the Henry Hyde seat, the open seat in Illinois. She lost both legs in Iraq. How could Republicans go to her and say, well, you know, Democrats are cut-and-run types, are weak on defense when you have somebody who is clearly sacrificed? Now, that sounds like the Republicans would never get away with that, but given the fact what happened to Max Cleland in Georgia, who also lost three limbs in Vietnam and was portrayed as somewhat less than patriotic when he ran for re-election in Georgia, you know, stranger things have happened.
Right. And what about the case in Ohio with veteran Paul Hackett pulling out of the race because he says that he wanted to make way for Brown, the congressional Democrat and veteran, to run against the Republican there? What do you think?
Well, that's a fascinating story. It's a little different story. Basically, Paul Hackett is somebody who did very well. He came from nowhere, an Iraqi war veteran who almost won a solidly Republican congressional seat last year. He was very strong against the war, very strong against Bush, and Democrats begged him, basically, to run for the Senate against Republican incumbent Mike DeWine in Ohio. So he ran and decided to run, and he's very controversial. He says what he's on his mind, but he was a little bit too controversial for some Democrats in Washington.
Just briefly, predictions. Do you think the Democrats will be able to win leadership of at least one House in November?
I don't. They will make gains in House and Senate, but they will not take over either chamber.
All right. Well, Ken, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Deborah.
Ken Rudin is political editor for National Public Radio. He spoke with us from Washington. Stay with us. There is more ahead, here and now. Rebecca, it's here and now. A new study using satellite imagery of the glaciers in Greenland is providing startling new evidence of global warming. The study, which is published in today's issue of the journal Science, indicates some ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are melting into the sea twice as fast as scientists first predicted. Researchers say this offers unambiguous evidence that global warming is progressing quickly enough to harm animal and human habitats in the not-so-distant future. Dr. Brenda Ertzwerkel is a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists in Boston. Dr. Ertzwerkel, what do we find out in this study about glaciers that we didn't already know?
What we know from the Greenland Glacier is that the amount of water volume that's stored up in this ice, if it were to all release over the next several centuries to thousands of years, it would raise sea level about 23 feet. So that's a lot of ice. What has scientists very concerned is that the peripheral outlet glaciers over just the last 5 years, their flow velocity has doubled. And that suggests that existing estimates of future sea level rise may be too low.
So that 23 feet may be reached quicker than we thought.
Well, it's a big ice cube sitting out there on top of Greenland. It's about the size of Mexico, and it's going to take a long time. In the past, it has taken 1,000 or more years to melt completely, and at the shortest time, it would take several centuries. But the peripheral glaciers, the fact that they are melting much faster than scientists have understood, means that the ice sheet is certainly responding to the warming of the planet.
Mm-hmm. One statistic that I read said that the amount of water produced by the melting ice is 225 times the volume of water that the city of Los Angeles consumes in a year.
It is massive. You need... We are talking volumes that are really hard to comprehend. For example, the mass deficit, the inland part of the Greenland ice sheet is growing a little bit, especially the northern part. The peripheral glaciers, especially south of 70 degrees north, are rapidly decreasing the mass. When you take the net balance, we've increased the mass deficit of the Greenland ice sheet from about 13 trillion gallons of water up to about 40 trillion gallons of water. And if it's just hard to imagine that many gallons of water.
And what happens with it all?
Most of it is directly running right into the sea, and we have fresh water adding directly to global sea level rise. That's a mass that's transferred from the land onto the oceans, and the oceans rise. The other big contributor to sea level rise is just the simple fact that they are warming. Just as hot air in a hot air balloon, when you heat it up, will expand that air, the ocean, when it warms up, it also will expand. And that is, this thermal expansion of the ocean is causing sea level rise. And we see with satellite measurements that the rate of rise has accelerated over the last 10 years compared to the rate over the last century.
And why is sea level rise important?
Sea level rise is important for many reasons, but there are island nations such as Tuvalu and other island nations that, with the projected rates of sea level rise over the next century, they are facing dire consequences. Low-lying areas such as Louisiana, parts of Florida. For example, if you took a 3-foot rise in sea level, that would mean that all of the keys in Florida and many of the Barrier Islands would be flooded in Florida.
And flooding of islands, while certainly serious, are there other serious implications from this sea level rise as well in terms of storm systems and things like that?
So you're exactly right. Storms are a critical. We know this today that, for example, when a nor'easter, say, storm system hits in the New England states, if it is hitting its highest storm energy during a spring tide, when the moon is aligned, so you have a very high tidal cycle, you have a higher sea level upon which the waves are coming in, you will sustain more coastal erosion and damage. Right now, what we're doing is essentially raising that base level that when storms come in, they can penetrate further inland in low-lying areas, and even areas with cliffs, you're going to have much more storm energy being propelled onto the coast and creating more erosion.
Hmm. Is this faster-than-expected melting unique to Greenland, or do you know if this is affecting other glacial regions as well?
We are seeing rapid glacial retreat in the Himalayas. We are seeing the ice shelves of the West Antarctic ice shelf are showing some rapid break-off, and we see that this is happening in a worldwide phenomena, but there are places around the world that are showing accumulation. There are few and far between, but one of the places is the glaciers of Norway, because they are receiving more precipitation. What happens is some of the warmer ocean just offshore in the North Atlantic is delivering some more precipitation, which is falling as snow on top of Norway. The East Antarctic ice sheet down south there is accumulating some snow. But worldwide, we're seeing mostly massive melting, and so that is what has climate scientists very alarmed with these new estimates released this week in the Journal of Science.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that this study in particular is just another study that sort of adds to all of that?
That's right. This is part of a longer-term trend. For example, 2005 was a record warm year, but what is more significant is that 18 out of the top 20 hottest years since 1880 have occurred since 1980. And so this is part of a longer-term warming trend, which is not unexpected given the high levels of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases we have in our atmosphere, which are amplifying the warming.
Thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel is a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists in Boston. Monday on Here and Now, how President Lincoln's melancholy shaped him as a human being and as a leader. And as more elderly people turn to assisted living, we look at efforts to impose standards on this largely unregulated industry. That's Monday. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now. Rebecca, it's Here and Now. Yao Ming, the 7-foot-6-inch center from China who plays for the Houston Rockets, is arguably the most popular player in NBA basketball. The proof is in the voting for Sunday night's NBA All-Star Game, which will be played on Yao's home court in Houston. 2.5 million fans cast their All-Star ballots for Yao Ming, more than any other player, and he'll be the starting center on the Western Conference All-Star team for the fourth straight year. Hampered by injuries this season, Yao Ming is still averaging around 20 points and 10 rebounds a game for the Rockets. They ended the first half of the season with a 109-75 loss to the Phoenix Suns last night. Yao scored just 6 points in that game, ending his streak of 54 straight games with 10 or more points. Yao Ming's journey from Shanghai to stardom in professional basketball in the U.S. is told in the book Operation Yao Ming, The Chinese Sports Empire, American Big Business, and the Making of an NBA Superstar. The author is Brooke Larmer, former Shanghai bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with Robin Young.
Let's explain the title first, Operation Yao Ming. Who were some of the players?
Operation Yao Ming actually refers to two operations. One was from the Chinese side, where the Chinese sports system was developed in the early years of Chairman Mao after the revolution in order to raise up what was considered in Asia the weak man of Asia, China, which had been trampled politically and had been humiliated on the athletic stage. So they created this sports system. Even back then, there was Yao Ming's grandfather was identified by a local coach in Shanghai. He was 6'8". Mm. But it wasn't until his son, Yao's father, came into adolescence that he was recruited into the sports system. Yao's mother was also recruited into the sports system. And eventually, when they retired, they were strongly encouraged to get together and gave birth to Yao Ming.
His parents were literally told by, again, this Soviet-style sports machine in China, listen, you two are very tall. We want you to hook up because we're hoping you'll produce a superstar.
Yeah, you have to put it into the context of China. China at that point was very poor. Arranged marriages were actually quite common. And within their work unit, and for them this was the sports authorities within China, it was very common for coaches and administrators to give suggestions to their players when they retired. And this was at age 28, which was quite late for most Chinese at that time to get married.
But still, it smacks of eugenics.
You could call it a passive form of eugenics, yes. Mm. I mean, certainly when Yao Ming was born, everybody knew that something special was on its way. He actually himself referred many years later to his childhood and says, you know, from the day I was born, I was reserved.
Reserved because he started to grow, just as the sports officials hoped when they matched up his tall basketball-playing parents. At age 8, he was already 5'7", and you write that the Chinese sports officials came to get him, and they said to his mom and dad, we can't wait any longer, he has to come with us. His parents had not had a good experience in the Chinese sports system, but they felt obligated to give him up. And for his part, Yao didn't want to go. He didn't like the game. He didn't have a knack for it. He didn't have much stamina. His coordination couldn't keep up with his rapid growth. In fact, you write that Yao Ming really wanted to be an archaeologist.
As a young child, his only talent really was his size. But for the children going into the system, it wasn't necessarily seen as being forced. Everything in China was the same system. It's simply that this system has persisted until today. The work units for the basketball players was not so different from the work units at the factories. So when they worked 6 to 8 hours a day, especially trying to show that revolutionary spirit, it didn't seem so unusual in the context of Chinese society. For many parents at that time also, this gave their son or daughters 3 square meals a day.
Yeah.
And so that it was looked at as a positive thing by some, almost as though it were joining the military.
In fact, meal tickets, ration tickets, were sometimes used as inspiration to get these kids to play more. You'll get more food.
That's right. Food was a huge motivating factor.
It's wild. Well, your book is really the story of two tall Chinese players. Yao Ming was one. Wang Zhizhi was the other. He was about 3 years older than Yao. He made it to the NBA first. He also came from tall stock, but he didn't fare as well.
He actually was the best-known player in China. He sprouted very young. He was 6 feet nine at the age of 13, and he became the star of the People's Liberation Army team, which was the strongest team in China. They have a long tradition in the Communist Army to excel in sports, and he was the epitome of this. He led them to 6 straight national titles and also the Chinese team to the Olympics. So he was much more famous than Yao inside China. But when he made the leap and to the NBA in 2001, and at that time, he was a national hero. Yeah. He was considered an ambassador from China to the United States just on the eve of the vote for the Beijing Olympics in 2008. So it was almost a goodwill gesture to show to the world that China wanted to participate in this grand world event.
But he then took the misstep of saying that he wanted his child to be born an American, and he wanted to get a passport and a green card, and they literally cut him off.
He had a difficult decision to make. At the end of his second season, he thought and feared that his NBA career might be over if he went back to China because his contract was running out with the Dallas Mavericks. The Army had not given him approval or a sign that he could continue. And he knew that he felt that he needed to go to the NBA Summer League to prove himself and to get a new contract. That individual decision, that choice to take his own destiny into his own hands, rubbed the authorities in China the wrong way. It created a huge mess on the eve of the draft that was supposed to pick Yao Ming, his longtime rival, to go to the NBA. So that small step led to an almost inevitable split with the Chinese government, in which he is considered now a pariah in his homeland.
But the outcome for Yao Ming is quite the opposite. He's a hero in China now, and I want to talk more about that. But first, tell us the American side of the story, because if Yao is a product of the Chinese sports system, he's also a product of the NBA and Nike. They wanted sneakers on all of those feet in China.
That's right. I mean, they looked for local heroes that could do for Nike or the NBA what Michael Jordan had done in the rest of the world. And Yao Ming and Wang Zhizhi stood above the rest as a potential NBA player. So they both locked in on these two players and tried to expose them to Western sporting mores and to bring them out, and also had to do this. They had to develop relationships not just with the boys and their families, but also with the Chinese sports system, which was much more difficult.
Right, and you describe a great scene where NBA Commissioner David Stern arrives at the offices of China State Television, and they clearly don't really care about it. They're not impressed. And he's used to having people be impressed.
That's right. At that point, it was 1990, his first trip to China. He was one of the most powerful sports personalities in the world. And he rolls up to the CCTV headquarters, which is the state TV monopoly. And not only was there no red carpet, but nobody was there to receive him, and nobody even knew who he was. He had to cool his heels down in the lobby for several hours before a low-level apparatchik came down and explained to him that Mr. Stern, in China at that point, TV was meant to ennoble the masses, not to entertain them. Mm-hmm. So it was a few years before the NBA actually started rolling, but that was kind of the first icebreaker. But on all of these encounters between the East and the West, there's a huge gap in business culture, where Nike and the NBA, coming from a hyper-capitalistic world, try to encounter this ambitious, growing Chinese market that is still, in many ways, especially in the sports system, locked back in that old socialist mentality.
Brooke Larmer is author of Operation Yao Ming, The Chinese Sports Empire, American Big Business, and the Making of an NBA Superstar. You're listening to Here and Now. And you tell us why, and it's obvious why, American businesses and the NBA would be interested in bringing basketball to this huge country. Now explain what China has at stake with Yao Ming, because, again, he's in the center of these two competing forces. It sort of tells us the history of sport in China, because at one time, you know, Chinese athletes weren't even allowed to win in international competition because it was seen as being, you know, bad for public relations. Tell us how Yao Ming illustrated the Chinese needs.
Yao Ming actually perfectly demonstrates the changing desires of the Chinese people and the Chinese government. 30 years ago, at the end of the Cultural Revolution, as you say, at that point it was called friendship first. If they had any foreign competition, it was in order to make friends. When Chairman Mao died and Deng Xiaoping took over, at that point, China really didn't just want to rejoin the world. They wanted to compete as equals. And that's when they first rejoined the Olympic movement. If you recall, their first re-entry into the Olympics was 1984.
A lot of people might remember. Wasn't that Los Angeles?
That was Los Angeles.
And the triumphant entering the stadium. And
that's right. There was the Soviet boycott of that Olympics. But Peter Ubaroth, who organized the LA Olympics, was just incredibly grateful to the Chinese for having broken that boycott. They didn't win that many medals. But in the 20 years since then, they have kind of climbed the medals ladder until in Athens, they won 32 gold medals compared to the United States, 35. And when the Olympics go to Beijing in 2008, they are determined to come out number one.
And Yao Ming is a part of this how? Because he plays for an American team. So how does he fulfill the needs of the Chinese?
It's very complicated, this relationship. But for Yao Ming as an individual, number one, he feels great loyalty to the Chinese, to China in general, but also to the authorities that raised him. He feels like he does owe the state something. On the other hand, unlike his former rival and sometime friend Wang Zhizhi, he is able to maintain these commercial relationships. And you can bet that if he did not have a good relationship with China, would McDonald's, Pepsi, Gatorade, Apple Computer, would they be pounding at his door? It would be very difficult for them to want to do that if he didn't actually give them access to the Chinese market. So It's a commercial thing as well. But yes, when he goes back to China, he feels somewhat sheepish about his wealth. His national team players don't have that money. So when he actually goes to practice, he will cramp himself into these little minivans to go to practice just like everyone else. He doesn't want any special treatment.
Well, you mentioned special treatment, and I wonder if the Chinese sports officials are wondering nervously how you're going to keep them down on the farm, because the Chinese sports machine, as you described it, really hasn't changed that much.
The sports system is changing gradually, and one of the ways in which it is that they're trying to introduce education more rigorously into the sports schools. Because unless they're Yao Ming and are going to be breaking through and making these tens of millions of dollars, there's not a lot of future for a failed athlete, especially if you have no education. What China is now is it has a wealth of opportunities for people who are educated. Yeah. But as you point out, even though their sports system has created these symbols of China's modern advancement, everyone is proud of Yao Ming and the gold medalist as a sign that China is now strong again. These symbols are actually the products of one of the last bastions of state socialism in China. And the reformers within the system had bittersweet feelings when China won the 2008 Olympics, because on one hand, of course they're proud. This is a great moment for China. But on the other hand, they may not see any reforms within the system or any serious reforms that give individual athletes the freedom to make choices in their lives until well after 2008.
And what about Yao Ming, Brooke Larmer? The one moment of joy related to basketball that I pick up in the book is when, as a younger person, he sees the Harlem Globetrotters who have come to China, and he thinks, wow, this could be fun. He didn't have a lot of fun with basketball. How would you describe him now, this person upon whom so many people have placed their expectations?
There is something that's sad about his case, even though he is a multi-millionaire. And one of the reasons I focus this book not just on him but on Wang Zhizhi is that back in China, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of athletes who don't reach the level of either of these players. And when they don't succeed, that, I think, is a greater tragedy than either of these players.
Brooke Larmer is author of Operation Yao Ming, The Chinese Sports Empire, American Big Business, and the Making of an NBA Superstar. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Deborah Becker, it's Here and Now. That's the sound of the Boston-based Brazilian group Samba Trimatera in rehearsal, getting ready for Carnival, that glitzy, hedonistic celebration marked first and foremost in Brazil. Rio and other major Brazilian cities offer a healthy serving of samba, street parades, feathers, beads, body paint, and beats. Although New Orleans' Mardi Gras celebration may be scaled down this year, Carnival in Brazil is sure to be as decadent as ever, and a Texan Brazilophile, Mike Quinn, is trying to export that. He's been organizing one of the largest indoor Carnival celebrations outside of Brazil, in all places, Austin, Texas, and he's bringing that party to the historically buttoned-up city of Boston. Robin Young talked with Quinn about the music behind Carnival. He was joined later on by Brazilian musicians Carlos Almeida and Davi Vieira. Here's Robin.
Well, samba music is something tied in America's imagination to Carnival. But let's have some history here. You say it wasn't always so.
Well, the music of Carnival started out as almost coming out of a Chopin kind of salon music. And that evolved into something a little bit more raucous as the African rhythms started coming into it in the early part of the 20th century.
But really, it was, I mean, would you go so far as to say staid? I'm still stuck on Chopin.
I think you'd be surprised at how kind of funny it would sound to the modern ear.
Well, as a matter of fact, let's listen to some of the early music. We have Baiano's Pelo Telefone. It's the first known samba ever recorded, and it was recorded
correct
in 1917. Let's listen. Wow, that's really not what we're hearing today, is it?
That's very different. If you can pull out some of the Africanisms there, you can almost hear a Scott Joplin kind of ragtime.
Right. And again, that was recorded in 1917, but you tell us that the idea of writing songs for Carnival really began in the 1800s. We just don't have recordings of them.
That's right. Reputedly, the first song written for Carnival was written by a woman named Chiquinha Gonzaga, probably in the 1898, something
right
like that.
Right. Well, the music has definitely become faster, louder. You picked out a few tunes from big marching bands to make that clear. Here's a 1962 recording by Mansueto, Batacada. And then the beat. That's the familiar sound, Mike Quinn. Is that more of the African influence on the...
Oh, yeah. You hear the beat on the two instead of the one, which is more European. All kinds of syncopation in that particular selection. You'll hear a guy rubbing a knife on a dinner plate to get a percussion sound.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Pretty common in those days. And I know we've got something to listen to, I guess, here by a very modern bloco.
Bloco? What is that?
Well, a bloco is that kind of a carnival organization usually associated with a neighborhood or some kind of a group and parade through the neighborhood at some point. And this is very, very common in Rio. There are blocos everywhere.
And it's a song called Domingo. Your thoughts on it before we hear it?
The thing about this particular recording is that it's the most accurate reproduction of what I hear in Brazil in a samba school ensaio or rehearsal. This is what a modern samba school sounds like, taking all the percussion instruments and speeding them up about 30% from what we heard before and just pushing the envelope as hard as you possibly can.
Let's listen. It's fun, and we're all moving in here, but it's funny because having heard what you said, it feels a little less warm.
It doesn't have the same swing as the older cut we heard by Monsueto. It doesn't have that jinga, as they say, the thing that kind of makes if I can say this on the radio, your butt cheeks kind of wiggle around in
a
certain kind of way.
You just did. And Carlos Almeida, Carlinhos, and Davi Vieira, both here to give us a sense of this music. Davi, do you agree that there's been some sort of, it sounds like almost a competition to make it louder and faster and brighter?
For me, because I'm really energetic. It's like once you there, you dancing, that's what you want.
Right.
You know,
you
don't feel like it's that fast. But then when you stop to listen to the music, they're like, oh my God, it's fast. Once you're there dancing, participating, you don't feel like that.
Well, you're not analyzing it the way we are here. Well, in fact, let's listen to a little more. And by the way, Davi has some drums with him. And I walked in and said, hey, weren't you in Stomp? You were several years in Stomp off Broadway, right? The Broadway production. So he knows a thing about percussion. And Carlos has his guitar there.
It's cavaquinho. It's a four-string guitar, acoustic guitar.
Yeah. That's Carlos Almeida from Grupo Severa in New York City, and accompanied on drums by Davi Vieira from Bahia in Brazil, and now both here. And exporting this music along with Mike Quinn to places in the United States, including Austin and Boston, which, hard to believe. Play a little something for us, some of your sound.
I'd like to show you guys the traditional instrument, percussion instrument from Bahia. It's music called timbal.
It's a big, tall, this case, black drum. Reaches up to his hips. Oh, and you're hooking it on. That's what we're used to see. Okay. And as he hooks the drum up to the strap around his neck, let us remind you that you can get more information about the U.S. celebrations of Brazilian-style Carnaval on our website, here-now.org. Mike Quinn, music lover and producer of Carnaval Brasileiro, which is now playing in Austin and coming to Boston and perhaps other cities. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for coming in to talk samba with us, the music behind Carnaval.
Thanks for letting us make a little noise.
And Carlinhos Almeida from Grupo Severa and musician Davi Vieira, thank you as well. And how about you play us out a little bit? Is there something you can... Okay, here we go.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah.